January 26, 2010, Mayapur, Part 2 on Ishvanshan Introduction. Sorry, it's taking its time. And yes, you're right, who was saying that? Ah, yes, that we could have discussed those for a lot more than 20 minutes. We could have talked about each of those topics for a couple of years. So this introduction to the Ishvanshad is basically comparing imperfect knowledge gained from sense perception and logic with perfect knowledge gained from the Shastra. Two particularly nice slides here. I did only a tiny bit of work to this. Jen last week, we did most of it. There's a couple really nice slides here that explain a whole overview of the Vedas. That's for next week. So this is a topic that Prabhupada talks about a lot. What are the four defects of a conditioned soul? Why can't we gain perfect knowledge? And what's really interesting is that it's not just devotees who say this, but materialistic scientists and teachers will tell you the same thing. They may explain the defects a little bit differently. But they'll also admit that all of their knowledge is defective, that they're not able to have actual knowledge. So this is my favorite quote about what does it mean to commit mistakes. And I think that the concept of committing mistakes as a defect of the conditioned souls is something that's very poorly understood by most devotees. Now, in the introduction, Prabhupada gives the example of Gandhi, who made a lot of mistakes. And he talks about how Gandhi went to a meeting even though he was warned that he would be assassinated. And also I know that when Prabhupada talked to us in 75, he said how Gandhi said there was never such a person as Krishna ever living. And he gave that also as a mistake. But here in the purport to Mantra 18, Prabhupada gives a very interesting definition of a mistake. How does Prabhupada here define mistakes? Unintentional sins. Do you remember we had the definition of sin yesterday in Ishvanshad? What was a sin? Yes? Deliberate disobedience. So if it's deliberate, how could it be unintentional? If it's deliberate, how can it be unintentional? Yes, you don't know. You don't know. Just like you guys were saying about material and spiritual desires, that sometimes you think something's a spiritual desire and gradually you see it's not. Right? So sometimes there can be weeds that look just like the bhakti creeper. So if a person is conditioned, they may not recognize what's deliberate disobedience. They may not recognize that they're actually acting out of harmony with the will of God. And therefore, it's a mistake. It leads a person to some unwanted result, to something catastrophic. So this tendency of a conditioned soul to think something is good when actually it's bad, to do something out of harmony with Krishna, out of harmony with reality, but think, oh, this is a very good thing to do. Now, sometimes people think mistakes means that you put your right shoe on your left foot. And they're thinking that liberated souls don't make those kind of mistakes. And here's a very nice letter that Srila Prabhupada wrote to Atreya Rishi. I suggest you read the whole letter, but this is a part of it. He said, "It's the nature of the living condition to always have some fault, even in the spiritual world. Once Krishna was so much attracted to Radharani that by mistake," he used the words here, mistake, "he tried to milk the bull instead of the cow. And sometimes when the gopis used to put on their dress and makeup for seeing Krishna, they would be too much hasty and smear kumkum and mascara on the wrong places, and their ornaments and dresses would appear as if small children had been trying to dress themselves, and they were not very expert like that. There are so many examples. It is not the same as material fault or material envy. So we should not expect that anywhere there is any utopia. Rather, that is impersonalism." So that's not the kind of... When we're talking about the four defects of a conditioned soul, we're not talking about that kind of mistake, that you might put the top part of your sari on the bottom part, or only put on one earring, or because those sort of mistakes are made even by Krishna. Just like sometimes our Prabhupada quotes a wrong verse or quotes a verse incorrectly in a lecture. Or one time, instead of saying, "I'm going to New Vrindavan," which is in West Virginia, he said, "I'm going to New Virginia." So those kind of mistakes even are made by Krishna and the gopis. But the conditioned soul tends to make the mistake of doing things that are evil and sinful without realizing it, and thinking, "Oh, actually, this is a very nice thing to do." We're talking the other day about maps. How you have to know where you're going, whether or not you have a right map. So someone thinks, "Yeah, this is the way that will take me to everything I desire," and actually, they're just going to fall off a cliff. It's going to fall off the edge. Okay, the next defect is pramada, which means really madness or illusion, thinking something is not. And this is especially accepting the body as a self. I think that's really ugly. Yes. I think it's actually really gross.
It looks plastic.
Yeah. It's really nice how Krishna is the strongest, but he doesn't look like that. He looks like this beautiful little delicate boy, even though he's so strong. So cheating, of course, we also cheat ourselves. The main person we're cheating is ourself. We're telling ourselves, "Yes, I'm this, I'm that, I'm the other thing, I'm so wonderful, I know everything." That's called justification, where we convince ourselves that everything is like this or like that when really it's not, when we cover our own bad qualities and our own defects. So that's a kind of cheating where we're not even aware that we're cheating. And then there's deliberate cheating, where we present ourselves as something that we're not. We present ourselves as knowing something that we don't know, or being something that we're not. This ability to be fully honest, we talked about the mode of goodness. What's the Sanskrit word for goodness? Which also means?
Truth.
So Krishna is, of course, Param Sattvam, the absolute truth. And to be in harmony with the absolute truth, we also have to be completely honest, completely true. If you think deeply about humility, humility and honesty are really the same thing. And this desire to cheat, it's a very deep-rooted desire. We don't want to appear foolish, isn't it? We don't want to appear foolish. We don't want to appear fallen. And it's such a deep-rooted desire. I've been dealing somewhat with one devotee who did something not very nice and who just doesn't want to admit it. And he was saying to me, "If I admit that I did this bad thing, then I'll lose my service, nobody will like me anymore. All these terrible things will happen if I'm honest. I want to go on pretending," right? And there's so much evidence that he's done this thing, and all he'll say is, "Well, I'm not admitting it."
It's very interesting. He won't say, I didn't do it. He'll say, I'm not admitting that. I'm not admitting that. I'm not admitting that. And we're so afraid that if we're truthful, we're going to suffer. And if we're honest, so instead we cheat. This cheating propensity is the main reason why it is said that a conditioned soul has no good qualities, which is an interesting statement. Prahlad Maharaj makes that statement. And of course, sometimes Prabhupada will say that ordinary people have so many good qualities. So what do we mean by the fact that someone who's not pure has no good qualities? Because for every good quality, there is a point at which that person will cheat. There's a point at which they'll give up their good quality. Just like I'm sure each of us in this room feel that we're honest people, that we don't steal. But if our life was threatened enough, we might steal. If we felt that being honest might make us suffer, and the only way to get what we need would be by stealing, at a certain point, every conditioned soul would steal. In other words, they get to a certain point where you're afraid to keep that good quality. Whether it's telling the truth, whether it's not stealing, whether it's being kind to others, there's a certain point where we feel that my own existence is threatened enough that I can give up my good quality. And we basically do something that's cheating. We do something that's no longer honest. But this cheating is based very strongly on fear. So, of course, here Prabhupada's talking about something that's done deliberately, but it may not even be done consciously. Our whole existence in the material world is a kind of cheating. That we're pretending to be something that we're not. What's really interesting, if you study on higher levels, what's called the philosophy of science or philosophy of research, the scientists will tell you that it's impossible to gain perfect knowledge through just the senses and the mind. It's impossible. You can't do it. They give 6 defects of empirical knowledge. They say, you can't do it. And yet, then they'll turn around and say, okay, now we're going to look at empirical knowledge as if it's knowledge. And to me, that's like saying, here's a map, and we know the map is defective. In fact, the map may be 100% defective. We don't know what percentage of it is defective. We don't know what parts are right, what parts are wrong. We don't know if any parts of it are right. But here's the map. It'll take you to your destination. So that's cheating. Okay, and then imperfect senses. So again, everybody knows this. We all know that we can only see certain parts of lights or hear certain sounds. And even with instruments, we can only enlarge that to a certain extent. And yet we want to see God. Yet we think we can understand everything in the universe. Oh, that should be 4. Uh-huh. That should be 4, Jim. We'll fix that right now while we're thinking about it. That should be 4.
What does the word vipralipsa actually mean?
The literal meaning? I don't know. Good question. Why does that show up as 3? Aha. Then it's off. It's not in the... Okay, that's good enough. Slightly different size 4, but at least it's 4. So you've all seen this picture?
Yeah.
Is it a young woman or an old woman? It's both. Right? If it's a young woman, there's her nose, and if it's the old woman, there's her nose. If it's a young woman, that's a necklace, and if it's an old woman, that's a mouth. So these lines appear bent, but actually they're straight.
does appear to be going like this, right?
Wow.
My sister used to make art like this. It's like, oh, they appear to be moving, right? This is like the blind man and the elephant. So one said the elephant's like a pillar, one said it's like a rope, one said it's like a wall, and it said it's like an arrow. Actually, he didn't say it was like an axe, he said it was like a fan. One said it was like a snake. They're just seeing a little different piece. There's a really good book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. It's a very difficult book to understand. I suggest that if you get that book, you also get some notes. And there it's explained that the way people come to scientific knowledge, it's not the way that we were told as children. It's not that the scientists have some body of knowledge that they get through their senses and their mind, and then there's something else comes up over here, and then they slightly modify their theory to include that, and then something else comes up and they modify their theory to include that, and something comes up and they modify their theory to include that, and pretty soon they understand everything. It's not like that at all. What it is the scientists are looking at a little tiny piece of reality, and they come up with a theory that explains that piece. And then something comes up that doesn't fit. Just doesn't fit their theory. And first they ignore those things, or they try to fit it. And if enough of those things come up, they change their theory. But it's not that they take this theory and enlarge it. They then look over here. So their new theory explains these things, and it doesn't explain these things. And that's very much like the blind man and the elephant. If the elephant is all in reality, you have a theory that just explains the leg or a theory that just explains the tail, but they're not able to come up with any explanation of reality that explains everything. Whatever explanation they come up with, it explains some things and it doesn't explain others. And there's nothing that explains everything. And it's by Thomas Kuhn called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. It's a classic book as far as understanding the philosophy of research and the philosophy of empiricism. So it's not that scientists are ever coming closer and closer and closer to the truth. That's not what's happening. It's just like if you had, I'm looking if someone has a sari like this, but nobody does. If you have a fabric that has a very complicated design on it, and you're just looking at different parts of the design, but you never see the whole thing. You never see how it all fits together. Oops, go back. Oops, come on, just go back. There we go. Okay, so there's Pratyakshan Anuman. Pratyakshan means what you perceive directly with your senses. Did we talk about this before, about this table and how we know it's reality?
Yes.
What did we say? Who remembers? But why we decide that this table exists, yes? Because we can all see it. Because we all see it and we all agree on what it is. We all agree what size it is, what shape it is, what color it is, and what it is. Therefore, we decide that this table is real and that how I perceive this table is correct. What's wrong with that? Well, we might all be an illusion. We might all be in the same illusion. And the empiricists know that this is a problem and have no answer for it. They know that it's a problem. Because they know that we can only perceive certain things. I can only perceive certain light. Correct? My eyes cannot see all the kinds of light that exist. With machines, I can see a few more, but maybe there's some more I can't even measure with a machine. Maybe there's parts of this table I can't see or feel, but they're here. Freaky, huh? Might there be living... Are there living entities in this room I can't see? Well, we know there's little tiny living entities in this room I can't see. Might there be other living entities in this room I can't see that I can't touch? Sure. So my sense perception is limited. Maybe I'm only seeing part of the elephant. Maybe I'm not seeing the whole elephant. One of my old
friends, I think I might have told you this, one of my old friends contacted me recently on Facebook, and we were chatting for a while, and he said, well, my idea of reality is that the only thing I trust is what I perceive with my senses. I know that that's very defective, but it's all I have. I know that isn't telling me truth or reality, but that's the only thing I trust. So it's exactly like the scientists are saying, this map is defective. And not only is it defective, we don't know where it's defective. We know for sure that it's not an actual map. Just imagine, someone gave you a map of the whole nine islands of Navadvipa and said, I can tell you right now that this is not an accurate map. But I don't know which parts are accurate and which parts are not. In fact, I don't know if the whole thing is inaccurate or parts of it are right. I have no way of judging. Would you use that map? But that's what most people in the world are doing today. Now, anuman is logic. Taking what you perceive with your senses and making logical sense out of it. Making generalizations. Just like I know this is a chair and this is a chair and that's a chair, even though they look quite different. That's a logical conclusion. Are projection anuman useful? Absolutely. Of course they're useful. Do we use prajaksha and anuman to understand the shastra? Of course. I pick up the book with my hands. I read it with my eyes. I try to understand it with my intelligence. As Krishna says, when you study the Bhagavad Gita, you worship him through your intelligence. But if that's the only thing that you're doing, if that's your only source of knowledge, then you don't know. Do you remember when you were a child, did you play that hot and cold game? Somebody hides something, and then you're looking for it, and the person who hit it says, you're getting hotter, 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 no, colder, colder, colder. So when empiricists are trying to, empiricists means someone who just uses their senses and logic, when they're trying to find truth, they don't hear any voice in the sky saying, you're getting hotter, you're getting hotter, you're getting colder, you're getting... They never have any idea if they're getting closer to the truth or farther away from it. So then there's also hearing from authority. By the way, nobody can do without hearing from authority. Nobody. There's some examples of children that were raised away from humans, wild children they call them. Feral children. And they never develop properly. No matter what training they get, they just don't develop properly. We're always starting with something. The famous philosopher Descartes said, what is a truth that I can start from? And he decided, I can start from my own existence. I think, therefore I am. He decided the most essential thing you can decide is I exist. I may not know whether or not the world exists. Do we know for sure with our senses and logic whether or not this world exists? No. We certainly do not. But I do know that I exist. That's about the only thing I can absolutely know. But everyone starts with something. When people studying science, mathematics, they start with what's called axioms, such as two parallel lines will never meet. Do we know that? No. How do you know that? If you take them up to Mars, maybe they'll meet. You know, we don't know whether or not, I mentioned this before in terms of the three modes of nature, we don't know whether or not the laws of physics, chemistry, and mathematics as they work on this planet. First of all, we don't fully understand them on this planet. However much they might like to convince you of that when you're 12. If you get, again, into the higher levels of science, of physics, chemistry, and mathematics, once you start getting up to graduate levels, they will openly admit, we do not understand all the laws of physics, chemistry, or mathematics, and we do not know what of our understanding is right and what is not. But we certainly don't know whether or not those laws apply in the same way on other planets. We just don't know. Do they apply in the same way all over the universe? So maybe two parallel lines do meet. How can you start with that as an absolute truth? You can really only start with it as a relative truth. And in fact, Narada Muni describes to Yudhisthira that on Brahma's planet, his assembly house has dimensions that are constantly shifting. You can't tell what the dimensions of it are. So we don't know. But everyone starts with some non-negotiable, non-arguing point, like two parallel lines will never meet. This is a point, this is a square, this is, and you start from that, isn't it? You always start with some, even people who use what's called induction, where you supposedly just start with sense perception, they're really always starting from some agreed upon truth. And sometimes that changes, as Kuhn describes. Sometimes these basic truths, which he calls paradigms, he's the one who started the word paradigm, shift. Sometimes the scientists say, wait a minute, our assumed truths are not true. And there's what's called a paradigm shift. So the authority that we want to hear from is authority that actually can see the whole elephant. The authority that designed the city. We'll get our map from the city designer, from someone who sees the whole picture. And that comes down through the chain of disciplic succession. Nice picture. I like this picture. Where'd you get that picture from? Where'd you get this picture from? It's a really nice picture.
I'm not sure. I have a collection of different PowerPoint slides. I'm not sure who's the origin. Mm-hmm.
Really? It's really nice picture. But this is something Prabhupada quotes a lot. Of course, we're losing this part of this slide. Anyway. Tadvignartam sagrum eva bigachet. One must approach a guru if you want transcendental knowledge. Not that you approach a guru so you can put up a picture of the guru in your house and say, there's my guru. When Prabhupada would talk like this, I used to think that that had something to do with people outside ISKCON. I've come to see that people in ISKCON can do that too. You know, yes, this is my guru. Do you follow? Oh no, but there's my guru. And samit pani shrotiyam brahmanishtam. If you want to come to brahmanishtam, remember we talked about kanista? Kanista, the unsteady. If you want to come to nishta, at which point trying to become Krishna conscious is no longer a struggle with the mind and senses. So one has to do menial service, like carrying firewood. Of course, we don't carry much firewood nowadays, do we? But one has to be willing to do menial service. So we could say, well, why accept Vedic authority? I mean, one of the things that, if we're honest, we will admit, is that whoever you accept as your authority for those things you can't prove, like two parallel lines will never meet, you just have to have faith. If you go to your teacher in school and say, I don't accept this, maybe on Mars two parallel lines do meet. Mm-hmm. You know, then you'll fail your mathematics exam. You can't really prove it. I think we have to admit that we get to a point where there's faith. One exercise I often do, which I don't have time to do today, is where we discuss what can we know about reality just through projection, anuman. What can we know just through our senses and logic? We can understand that there's a God. We can understand that God is very orderly, very creative, very intelligent. There's so many things we can understand just with our senses and logic. But then we reach a point that we have to have faith. I mean, just a simple example would be those curtains on the wall. They're pretty simple. That curtain is a pretty simple object. But yet, if I said to you, a two-year-old child made the curtain, you wouldn't believe me. If I said a monkey made it, you wouldn't believe me. If I said, you know, a bird made it. So it had, and if what to speak of if I said nobody made it, just appeared. We came in one day and there was a curtain and nobody made it. So we can immediately understand that that curtain, even though it's an extremely simple object, is the product of intelligence. So in the same way, we can look at the world and see that the world is also a product of intelligence and planning and creativity. But if I want to know who made that curtain, I can understand it must be somebody who's intelligent. I understand it must be somebody, it must be a person, it must be a human being. Has to be somebody probably over the age of 5, most likely over the age of 10. So I could look at the stitching and see how careful the person is.
I could tell you something about the personality of the person who made that curtain, but not very much. Especially if I'm not sure, did that person choose the color or did someone else choose the color? There's a lot of information that I don't. I get to a point where I'm stuck and where I have to then have faith. If you say, oh, anyway, here's the person who made the curtain, and I have to believe you or not. If you tell me, I'm the person who made the curtain, I have to believe you. I mean, even if you take a photograph of yourself making the curtain, maybe you created it on Photoshop. Or someone else says, I saw that person maybe making the curtain. Maybe they're lying. I get to a point where I'm stuck. I have to have faith. So that's true even in ordinary things. And when we're trying to understand ultimate reality, there's many things we can understand through projection, anuman. But we reach a certain point where we get stuck. And in order to understand more than that, to understand that God is blue, that you need faith. And then you can't understand that through logic. That he herds cows. I mean, maybe he herds sheep. How do you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to, that is a question of faith. Now, of course, it's interesting for statements like this, because what did Prabhupada say in the 14th chapter? Remember the beginning of the 14th chapter? He said we have to understand these things through? Come on, we did a whole exercise on it. We have to understand these things through philosophical speculation. Yes, there you go. Okay. What happens if you try to take all the words of the scripture as all being absolutely literally true? What will happen? You'll find a lot of contradictions. That which descends. By the way, sometimes people, Prabhupada likes to quote a Christian saying, the devil cites Shastra, the devil cites scripture. So can you pull out a quote from scripture to prove almost anything?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. We see sometimes devotees do this. They have scripture wars. Right? Throwing quotes at each other. So when I accept descending knowledge, what does that mean? When I say I accept the scriptures as they are, without change, what does that mean? But how do I do that? How do I, as an individual, accept the authority of the Vedas? How do we do that? Okay, we have a spiritual master who explains how to apply it, how to understand it. What else? The disciplic succession. What else? Through devotional service, what happens? The scriptures get what?
Revealed.
Doesn't that happen? As you're reading the books, all of a sudden you go, wow. Where did that sentence come from? Don't you have that experience? It gets revealed to you more and more and more. As you please Krishna, he reveals himself in the Shastra. In fact, the only way really to understand the Shastra is through revelation. That's the only way to really understand. And on a practical level, on a materially practical level, what else? So we see how the guru has understood the Shastra, how the sadhus have understood the Shastra. And also you understand in context. What is the context? What is going on around this quote? Who's speaking it? In what circumstance? And also you understand the whole Shastra. That's why it's so important to study the whole Bhagavad Gita and the whole Bhagavatam and the whole Chaitanya Charitamrita. Then you get the big picture and you can understand how this particular statement or this particular circumstance fits in with everything. Otherwise, if you take something by itself, you may not be able to understand how it's part of the greater picture. That's just honest research, even for materialists. Even materialists will say, if you want to understand something, you have to understand the whole thing. You can't just take a piece of it. But ultimately, it's through revelation. Ultimately, it's through purity. If we really want to understand the scriptures, it should be through purity. And I'm going to challenge all of you. If we admit, at least to ourselves, that we're not experiencing a thrill at every moment and floating in an ocean of prema with the 9 sattvic bhavs of love of God, then that means we're still to some extent conditioned. more or less conditioned. And if I'm conditioned, then I must have the four defects. Are we agreed about this?
Yes.
So that means I must have the four defects. Not just that you have them, or that that materialistic scientist, that rascal, nonsense, materialistic, carny scientist has them, but that I have them. Now, if I have those defects, then when I'm studying Shastra or when I'm hearing from authorities, what's happening? I'm not me. Not me. Definitely. It's being filtered through the modes of nature that are covering me. One time I was involved in an email conversation with many, many devotees, and one devotee wrote one letter in all capitals. That is Krishna's opinion. And someone commented and said, no, that's your interpretation of the Shastra, and you think your opinion is as good as Krishna's opinion. So we should be very careful. I find it sadly funny that although we preach the fact that we have the four defects, and we all of us, we've learned in the Hare Krishna movement to always say that we're fallen. That's one of our, yes, I'm so fallen. It's one of our mantras. Somehow, when it comes to how we understand the Shastra and the philosophy, we seem not to believe it. And we tend to think that my understanding of the Shastra is the Shastra. It's interesting. If I'll say my understanding of this table may not be the table. This table may have something different about it that I'm not able to perceive. But yet I'll say my understanding of the Shastra is the Shastra. Quite interesting. So please have some humility. We should all have some humility and understand that unless I'm on a very elevated platform, my understanding of the Shastra is imperfect. It's incomplete and it's imperfect. By the way, even those who are liberated sometimes understand Krishna differently. We talked about this before. If the absolute truth is described differently by different persons, that tells us that the absolute truth must be a
person.
Yes.
The fact that Prabhupada said Bhagavad Gita as it is, that we don't deliberate, we just accept as it is, we don't add anything, we don't take anything.
Okay, what about what Prabhupada says in the 14th chapter? What did he say? Again, what did Prabhupada say, 14th chapter Bhagavad Gita? You should understand all this through the philosophical speculation. How is it true? Didn't we take topics and do that? Mm-hmm. Krishna says, I'm the heat, I'm the light, I'm the fire. How is Krishna heat? How is he light? How is he fire? Remember we did that? So even if you're saying, I'm accepting as it is, are you really hearing as it is? That's the first question is, are you really hearing as it is? That's the first question to ask yourself. Am I capable of hearing as it is as long as I'm covered by the modes of nature? Just theoretically, according to our philosophy, are we capable of hearing as it is while we're covered by the modes of nature? No, we're not. We're capable of hearing some things to some extent. We're not capable of understanding everything. So that's the first thing. Even if I'm just repeating the Shastra, am I fully understanding when I'm repeating? No. And one evidence of that is how your understanding deepens, doesn't it? As you go on chanting and you go on serving, all of a sudden you go, wow, that's what it means. And, you know, 5 years later with the same thing, you go, oh, it means that. And 5 years later with the same thing, isn't it? Do you have this experience? So as the coverings are removed, we start seeing things more and more and more and more and more clearly. So Shastra as it is does not just mean pulling out a quote and repeating it word for word. Because we see that devotees do that and fight about their quotes. Do you have this experience? I have this experience. Here, take this quote. But it means realization. It means coming to a higher level of consciousness. So of course we can only follow as we understand it at this particular moment, but we should do that with humility. That's my suggestion. Okay, here's a whole section which we're going to go over very quickly about how ISKCON gurus are supposed to follow Prabhupada. I'm sort of hoping that you all already know that. Maybe you don't already know that, but I'm hoping that you already know that. Is Here's our GBC resolution. Hopefully, everybody who's teaching in ISKCON is doing so according to Prabhupada's instructions. Of course, sometimes people debate over what's Prabhupada's instructions. Hare Krishna. This Bhakti Chuswami talked about this in class the other day, on Advaitacharya's appearance day. Any of you hear that class? Yes. And they were talking about, I could only hear it a little bit from the radio that my neighbor was playing. But he was talking about Advaitacharya's beard. Mm-hmm. Yes. So I'm on the Shastric Advisory Council, and we were asked to decide before these deities were installed here whether or not Advaitacharya should have a beard. And if you want to read our decision, you can go to dandavats.com, go to the archive section, and read the Shastric Advisory Council paper. But what was very interesting was that there's many places where Srila Prabhupada said that all the deities and all the paintings of Advaitacharya should show him as an older man with a beard. And there was many instructions like that from Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada personally supervised the deities in Hawaii, in Honolulu, which are Panchatattva deities, where Advaitacharya is shown as an elderly man with a beard. But guess who says that Advaitacharya doesn't have a beard? Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur. And he says that in a purport to Chaitanya Bhagavat, and interestingly enough, it's the verse in Chaitanya Bhagavat says Advaitacharya was, I forget the words, like playing with his beard, stroking his beard. Yes. The verse says, the Bengali is crystal clear, that Advaitacharya is stroking his beard. And in that purport, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati says he doesn't have a beard. He's clean shaven. So we had to look at that and say, why was Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati purporting this verse, the opposite to the obvious meaning, number one? And second of all, who do we follow? Because there's many, many temples of Advaitacharya where he's shown as a young man without a beard. And we reached several decisions. One is that Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati had a particular purpose. He said Advaitacharya is not a bowel, which is a particular group of people. He said he's not one of those people. And the other thing is that different devotees may see the Lord differently. Lord Kapiladev says that the Lord appears in whatever form the devotee worships him, and the different devotees may have different visions of Krishna, and that as Prabhupada's followers, we should follow Prabhupada. It doesn't mean that someone else is right or someone else is wrong, but that there were different visions and we would follow through a problem. So that was a very interesting discussion.
Someone said in the lecture that he did just to distinguish between
maybe. I don't know any quote like that. Okay, we don't have a whole lot of time. So this is that the different Vedas are dealing with different activities of the human being. And this is something I really like about the Vedic scriptures and Vedic society as contrasted, say, with the Bible or the Quran. That if you're a follower of the Bible, either you have to believe it or not. And there's really only one way of living. He looks very serious in that picture. Mm-hmm. He's usually smiling. Should have gotten a smiling picture. If you follow the Vedic scriptures, there's some facility for everyone. There's the Karmakanda section, there's the Jnanakarma section, there's the Bhakti section. So you can have a whole society where everyone's following the Vedas, and yet everything can be done according to people's different modes of nature and people's different desires. Do you all know Gopi Pranadana? Wonderful devotee. He's the one who translated the Brihad Bhagavatamrita. He's working on the Tat Sandarbhas. So he's talking about the role of the Upanishads, which is important since we're looking at one of the Upanishads. Shruti means what is heard. Can you all read that? Very tiny, tiny, tiny letters. Is that readable? These are such cool charts. So the words may change from H-A to Smriti. Smriti means what's remembered. These are the two main branches of Vedic knowledge. You know, it would be really nice if we had these charts printed out to give to people. Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Oh, it's a different chart.
Okay.
I sent you a word. I didn't give you the word. I have that in word.
That would be really nice to have this in word. So this is the four Vedas. Actually, here we just have three. There are no four. Rig, Yajur, Sama, and Atharva. The Samhitas, which are for brahmacharis. The Brahmanas, which are explanations for the grahasthas. The Aranyakas for the vanaprastas. And the Upanishads for the sannyasis. Karmakanda, I assume, just applies to the Samhitas and the Brahmanas. And Jnana Karma for the Aranyakas and the Upanishads. This is such a cool chart. Can you actually read that?
No.
I think it's very...
This is different than the projector I had in Jubal. Jubal, the right side margin.
Yeah, well, we keep trying to fix that. We can try again, but it's... It's interesting trying to fix it. It's already, yeah. We just can't. Sometimes we can and sometimes we can't, you know, just. At least it's working. At least our projector's working. That's a big thing around here. If it's working at all, even if the right side's cut off, you know, that's, we're happy. So Anga means limb, limbs of the Vedas. So there's rituals, pronunciation, grammar, meters, astrology. So these are the skills that you use, knowledge, skills, and values. There's also rituals, law books. History, itihasa means history, Mahabharat, which has Bhagavad Gita, Ramayana. How long did it take you to do this chart?
A long time.
I'll bet.
The research was heavy.
I'll bet. But even just the putting together the chart from the research must have taken a long time.
Yeah, I have that.
It'd be really, really nice to give everybody a printout of this. All right. Epistemology means, can you know anything for certain? How do you know it? Ontology is what can be known. Okay, so since the Upanishads have contradictory statements, Vyasadeva systematized them into the Vedanta Sutra. In order to understand the Vedanta Sutra, we have the Srimad Bhagavatam. So where Prabhupada's saying that we don't accept all of the six systems of philosophy. Sorry that we're going through this quickly. Here Prabhupada's just saying it's going beyond the limits of material nature. This is, I would strongly suggest that all of you become familiar with Das Mula Tattva. Bhaktivinoda Thakur presents these as absolute. There are many statements of the Shastra which are contradicted by other statements or which are made relative by other statements. So there are many statements of the Shastra that sound absolute but that are really general. Do you all understand what I mean by that? Suppose I say, oh, he never comes to the temple. Does that mean he absolutely never comes?
No.
It might mean he comes sometimes. So also the Shastra may say things like eternally conditioned. Or someone asked me about that all the living entities are under the modes of material nature. Remember Krishna said that? There's no being who's not under the modes of material nature. So there's many statements in the Shastra by the sages, by guru, that sound like they're absolute, but they can't be.
because there's different statements in different places. And here Bhaktivinoda Thakur is presenting the 10 statements that are absolute. Now, if you look at the four Vaishnav Sampradayas, most of them agree with most of these statements. The Madhva Sampradaya agrees with 8 of them, and I think the other 3 Sampradayas agree with 9 of them. And I don't have that analysis right now, although I have it in writing. So we have the Shruti and the Smriti. This Ishopanishad is, I believe, the only one of Srila Prabhupada's books that's from the Shruti. Everything else is from the Smriti. And it's very useful, therefore, if you're going to be preaching to some real Vedic scholar who says, well, we only accept the Shruti. Prabhupada saying that there are some scholars who say we only accept the Shruti. And some people have speculated that that's one of the reasons that Prabhupada translated the Ishopanishad, was to convince those sort of people. I don't know. I don't recall him ever saying anything like that, but that's certainly interesting.
I've checked with Jay Vaishnavi and the Buddha, and they never heard that.
They never heard that. It's certainly possible. But I don't think Prabhupada ever said that. Okay. Now I'm going to do this quickly. I think that's it. Is that it? Or is there any more? So this is that same chart with some stuff taken out. So this is basically what we in the Hare Krishna movement have as our Shastra. From the Shruti, we're taking the Upanishads, particularly the Ishopanishad and the Acharya's commentaries. From the Smriti, we're taking the Puranas, especially the Bhagavad Purana, the Srimad Bhagavatam, taking the Mahabharata, especially Bhagavad Gita, Ramayana, and the Vedanta Sutra. And those are our main scriptures. And then, of course, the commentaries, the Acharya's commentaries. We also have scriptures that come very much from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his associates, like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu explaining things to Rupa Goswami, who then wrote the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, explaining things to Sanatana Goswami, who wrote Hari Bhakti Vilas. We have Bhagavatamrita. Now we have a few more arrows. Oh, look at that, more arrows. Okay. Therefore, it's not something concocted. Our movement is not based on somebody, you know, going out and meditating in the desert and just saying, I have a realization. I'm going to start my own religion. There are religions in the world like that. Yes, there are some others too. I can think of at least another 3 that are like. Okay. All right, tomorrow we are going to go over 9 through 14. 9 through 14. Tomorrow we're going to look at wolves dressed up like sheep.
You said when we made a general statement, he never comes to the temple. That means, but occasionally he could be coming.
It could mean that.
Right. So similarly, I was thinking in regards to Advaita Acharya's beard. Men do grow beard, and he might just have had a beard that day, but usually he's shaved.
Could be. Oh, thank you. Thank you. So I have some papers here on Bhagavad Gita, which we wanted to pass out to you a long time ago. If you didn't get this chart on Ishopanishad, it's up here. That was passed out at the beginning of class. This is one chart about, this is a Bhagavad Gita in a chart form. So I'm going to give you the responsibility to make sure everybody gets that. And then, they left the 20-minute thing on it. Okay, this paper is, first of all, there's 3 pages that summarize the whole Bhagavad Gita. Mm-hmm. In very, very simple form. And then there's another 9 pages that give you a summary of the Bhagavad Gita in essay form.
So this is giving you, these three pages give you all the main points of the whole Bhagavad Gita, all the most important points. But if you want to see how the Bhagavad Gita flows together, how one chapter leads to the other, how it all makes sense as a unit, I think you'll find these nine pages very helpful. I put this together based on the work of, I don't know, about 10 different people. So if you would take responsibility, pass this out over here. And if you would take responsibility, pass it out on this side of the room. And we will see you tomorrow, Krishna willing. Hope you all have fun today.
Yes.
Are you all having fun today?
Yes.
My number one goal is that you all have fun. That's my number one goal. That you are relishing studying Shastra, because my number one goal is that whenever you think about Bhagavad Gita or Isha Upanishad, that you think, oh, that is fun. Because then you're more likely to pick it up again. That's my aim. I don't know if it's on your list of aims and objectives, but it's my chief aim.
Would you please put on again that slice of Dasamudra Paripa?
Sure.